Today we're going to continue to journey through God's Word and give an overview of the Bible. And hopefully you've had a chance to read or at least skim over the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. We're going to be covering from the time that the Israelites are in Egypt to the time that they're on the borders of the Promised Land. We'll begin with kind of that 30,000 foot overview of this section. We're covering about 400 years of biblical history in our study today, and kind of just the highlight, the bullet points of the things that are going to be covered here is we're going to see God drawing the people of Israel out of Egyptian bondage and making them into a unique nation by giving them laws and regulations and establishing a covenant relationship with them, and then actually dwelling, or more literally, tabernacling among them in the presence of the pillar of cloud and fire. We're going to see how this people, despite the blessings from God, consistently grumbled, showing a tendency to always turn away, at least in their hearts, from God, failing to trust in His promises, but rather to put their hope in the things of their past, where for the Israelites, they were formerly enslaved, Egypt. And throughout all of this, God is going to patiently bear with them, exercising discipline when it's necessary, but always extending grace and mercy and demonstrating love towards His people, and especially those whose hearts are fully His. And as we did last time, we're also going to be following this thread that goes from Genesis through Revelation, the entire story of God. You'll remember that there were some promises made to Abraham last time when we said specifically that through his seed, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And this was the unfolding of God's plan of redemption. And we're going to see the continuance of the unfolding of that plan and the pattern for redemption here, in that the seed of Abraham has now come to be the family of Israel, who is going to be brought out of Egypt and become a nation. And it's going to be through this nation of Israel that God will ultimately bring the Redeemer, Christ Jesus, into the world. And by establishing His covenant with the people of Israel, God is going to show a couple things. He's going to show, number one, what it's like to be in a covenant relationship with Him, to be called out of bondage, to live in a special, to live as His special possession. And through the giving of the law and all of its rules and regulations, He's going to clearly demonstrate the futility of trying to earn salvation by perfect law keeping. As we dig a little bit deeper into some of the major events that transpired over this 400 years, as I'm just going to try to tell it to you as though I'm relating a story. We ended our last section by talking about Joseph, and specifically the last event that we covered was the death of Joseph down in Egypt. And from the death of Joseph to the next major event, which is the birth of Moses, we have a period of about 275 years. So we're fast forwarding quite a bit here in the story. And it's during this time period in Egypt that there are about three major periods or ruling dynasties that are relevant over this time. The Middle Kingdom, the Second Intermediate Period, and then the New Kingdom. It's in the Middle Kingdom that the last of the great dynasties, the 12th dynasty, was in power at the time when Joseph was sold down into Egyptian bondage, and then later when his whole family came down to Egypt during the famine. But about 19 years after the death of Joseph, the 12th dynasty was succeeded by the much weaker 13th and 14th dynasties in Egypt. And so much so that within about 56 years, the weakness of those Egyptian rulers had gotten so bad that a foreign people, the Hyksos, were able to come down from Asia and actually take control of northern Egypt. And they ultimately took total control of Egypt, both in the north and the south, from about 1680 to 1660 BC. So for about 20 years, these foreigners ruled all of Egypt as though they were Egyptian rulers themselves. There was a 16th and 17th dynasty that kind of took back the southern portion of Egypt in the latter half of the Hyksos reign. But what's interesting about this is that it's probably during the reign of the Hyksos pharaohs that the Israelites were enslaved. But you'll remember there was a time when we're told that a new pharaoh arrived who knew not Joseph or any of the things that he had done. And this pharaoh, we're told, was one who feared Israel and specifically was fearful that if there was an uprising in Egypt, these Israelites might join their enemies and overthrow them. And so to prevent this from happening, they enslaved the Israelites who were living in the land of Goshen. They made them build cities. They built the city of Pithom and Ramses. And yet, despite all of their efforts to try to control the population growth of the Israelites just kept growing and expanding and becoming more and more numerous. At the end of the intermediate period, when we get into the New Kingdom, the 18th dynasty, one of the most powerful Egyptian dynasties, ascended to the throne and kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt completely. And it was probably Amose or Amenhotep who gave the order to the Hebrew midwives that they were to kill the male babies when they were being born. Of course, that was an order that the midwives refused to follow through on. And it was almost certainly Thutmose who was the pharaoh that gave the order to have the male Israelite children thrown into the Nile River, all in an effort to keep this booming population of the Israelites down. But again, everything that they tried to do was counterproductive. The Israelites just kept growing and becoming more and more numerous and more powerful. And so that brings us then to the time of Moses' birth, which you remember the story. He was hidden by his parents for a few months, and then when they couldn't hide him at home anymore, they put him in the basket and put him in the Nile River. He was discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, adopted into Pharaoh's house, where he was raised as an Egyptian. And then at about the age of 40, he decides to go out and check on his Hebrew brethren, and he ends up killing an Egyptian who's mistreating one of his fellow Hebrews. And when the new Pharaoh, who was a rival of Moses within the household of Pharaoh, learns of this, he's pretty ticked with Moses. And so Moses flees from Egypt to Midian. And there in Midian, Moses will spend about the next 40 years marrying, having two sons, and living as a shepherd, shepherding the flocks of his father-in-law, Jethro, in the plains and wilderness of Midian. Then at about 1447 BC, Moses is out shepherding his flocks, and he sees the most unusual sight, a bush that's on fire, but it's not burning up. And God speaks to Moses through this burning bush and gives Moses the commission to now go back to Egypt and confront Pharaoh and lead my people Israel out of bondage. Bring them to this mountain, Mount Sinai, where I will enter into a covenant relationship with them. And so that after some apprehension and some persuasion by God, Moses accepts this responsibility and returns to Egypt. And in the fall of that year, begins to confront Pharaoh, who at first is absolutely reluctant and refusing to let Israel go. And so God brings down over about the next 3 to 6 months, the 10 plagues on the nation of Egypt, beginning with turning the Nile River to blood and culminating in March of 1446 with the death of the firstborn and the Passover sacrifice, where they sacrificed the lamb and they took the blood and put it on the doorpost and the lintel of their door. And when the angel of death came through Egypt, it passed over those houses. And I want to just pause right here and just make mention of this, because this is connected to that thread that we're talking about. This Passover here becomes a shadow, a type of what Christ will ultimately be. Jesus will be called the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Here, a lamb had to die and its blood had to be shed so that God would pass over those houses and spare all who were inside. And so it was by applying the blood of the lamb to the doorpost and the lintel of the house that God passed over them and spared them. It will be by applying the blood of Christ to ourselves that God will be able to pass over our sin and spare our lives and bring us into a relationship with Him and ultimately bring us home to the promised land of heaven. And it's interesting that after this 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh has had a change of heart and he is practically chasing the Israelites out of Egypt. He's like, just get out of here before anything else bad happens to us. And so on the 15th day of the Israelites' first month of their first year, which corresponds roughly to our March of 1446, we're told that about 600,000 men, that's not including women, that's not including children, and it's not including this mixed multitude of people that are going out with them. So we're talking about a group of people of anywhere from 1.9 to 2.5 million people, plus all of their flocks and all of their herds, set out from Ramses in Egypt and begin to travel towards Mount Sinai, where God is going to meet with his people. And all along the way, God is leading them with his presence, a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And they come up to the Red Sea and they're trapped there, and God parts the waters and spares them from the Egyptian armies who've, again, changed their mind and are now pursuing them. Miraculously delivers them, and from the time that they cross the Red Sea and travel on down to Egypt, a period of less than 60 days that it took them to leave from Egypt to get to Sinai, during that time, God consistently provides for his people. He provides them with manna. He provides them with meat, the quail. He provides them with water from a rock, all of the things that they need to sustain themselves on their journey. And on the 15th day of the third month, they arrive at the base of Mount Sinai. And God instructs Moses to tell the people to consecrate themselves, to get ready, because on the third day, I'm going to come down on the mountain. And on the third day, God comes down on the top of the mountain in a blazing fire and smoke and thunder. And it's this awe-inspiring sight. And then God, from the mountain, proceeds to speak down the mountain, maybe the first Sermon on the Mount, the Ten Commandments to his new people. And of course, the people are terrified. They hear the thunder and they see the lightning and they see the fire and they are scared to death. And they say, Moses, we can't bear to hear God speak directly to us. You go up and you talk to him, get all of his instruction, everything that he has to say, and bring that down to us. But we can't bear to hear God speak anymore. And so Moses says, it's okay, I'll do that for you. But God needed to show himself to you in this way so that the fear of the Lord would be in you always. And so Moses goes up, receives some instructions, some parts of the covenant from God, comes back down, relates that information to the people, and they all agree, that's a good covenant. We're agreeing to enter into this covenant with God here on this occasion. And then Moses goes back up on the mountain to receive the rest of the law. And he's up on the mountain for a period of about 40 days and 40 nights. And while he's up there, God gives him all of the particulars of the instructions for how to build the tabernacle and all of the things that go in it and how they're going to worship him. And then he also gives him pretty much all of the rest of the law as well. Now, let me just pause right here and say this. The whole codified law is not recorded for us in the book of Exodus. There are instructions that are recorded for us in the book of Leviticus. In fact, all of the book of Leviticus was instruction that came from God after they had erected the tabernacle, but before they set out from Sinai. And then later on their journey, we're going to see in the book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy that there was clearly some supplemental information that God gives to the people along the way as they encounter various scenarios and situations. And that's going to be incorporated into the law. But again, we're not going to take the time to look at all of that together today. You can reference your outline if you're curious about that. I just want to make a couple quick observations regarding the law that jumped out at me when I was studying through it this time. Number one, the law is indeed a list of do's and don'ts. The law of Moses. In fact, by my count, there are several hundred thou shall statements in the law. Do this, do this, do this. And conversely, there's at least 250 thou shalt not statements. It very much is do this and don't do this. But the other thing that's really impressive to me about the law is that there's a couple points that are clearly driven home in the repetition of the law. Number one is that when you violate the law of God, when you sin, it requires a life. You know how many times, I didn't actually have a chance to go through and count it up, but it surprised me how many times the death penalty is the punishment for a violation of a certain law. Anything from breaking the Sabbath to kids being disrespectful to their parents, what do? You take them out. And almost every other law that's violated that doesn't necessitate a death penalty requires the sacrifice of a substitutionary animal to atone for the sin. And so over and over again, the law is saying, it's teaching us, when you violate God's law, when you sin against God, the cost of that is a life. And didn't Paul say the wages of sin is death? And so that point is being driven home to the Israelites here in the law. And the other thing that jumps out at me is almost impossibility to live up to the standard of the law. I mean, there are so many things in the law about ceremonial cleanness and things like that. I mean, just by virtue of living on any given day and taking a breath as an Israelite person, you are almost more than likely going to make yourself unclean. Women were unclean at least once a month. Married couples were unclean every time they got together. I mean, those are things that God designed us for, and yet the law says you're unclean. Just by virtue of being a human being under the law of Moses, you are going to inevitably become unclean in the eyes of the law. And that's a point that God's trying to drive home, that there is none of us who will ever be able to live perfectly and never defile ourselves. And again, that's part of the thread that carries on even under the covenant we live under. Because none of us have ever remained clean in the eyes of God. And so we need something to pay the cost for our sins. Well, Moses is up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights receiving this law. And the people grow tired of waiting for him. We don't know what's happened to him. He's been up there for a long time. Aaron, make a god for us to lead us back to Egypt. And so Aaron constructs the golden calf. And before Moses is done getting the law from God, Israel's already slipped back into idolatry. They've forsaken their covenant with him. And so Moses comes down. God is fiery, angry with the people. He actually says to Moses, I'm going to wipe them all out and I'll start over with you, Moses. And Moses says, no, God, don't do that. The nations will think that you couldn't handle it. And so God says, fine, I'll relent, but there will be a punishment. And Moses goes down, he smashes the tablets that have been given to him with the law on it. He grinds up their molten image, puts it on the water, and makes them drink it as punishment. And then God plagues the people. And the Levites end up going through the camp and slaughtering about 3,000 individuals on that day. And then God says to the people, you know what? Just leave. Just go out from here and go up to the land that I promised to give you, but I'm not going to go with you. And Moses again intercedes for the people and says, no, God, please don't send us without your presence. And so God says, fine, I will go with you. And Moses then goes back up on the mountain for another 40 days and 40 nights to receive the law all over again, because everything that he had gotten from God, he smashed at the base of the mountain. And so God gives it to him again over this period of 40 days and 40 nights. And then after Moses comes down, after seeing the glory of God on the mountain, his face shines and the people renew their covenant with God. And then over the next several months, they spend time manufacturing all of the components of the tabernacle and all of the furnishings that will go inside of it. And after they've been at Sinai for about 9.5 months, on the first day of the first month of the second year, the tabernacle is erected. and all of its implements and all of its things, and even Aaron and his sons are consecrated and set aside and dedicated for the worship that will happen in the tabernacle. And for the first time, God's people offer sacrifices to him according to the law. The presence of the Lord that had been dwelling with them in the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire now takes up its residence over top of the tabernacle. And as long as that cloud remained there on the tabernacle, the camp would stay in camp. God gave instructions, when I lift the cloud up, that's the signal that the camp is supposed to gather up and we're going to move on to the next place until I settle down there as well. But what's interesting to me is that in spite of all of these great things that are happening, again, within 14 days of having the tabernacle set up and Aaron and his sons being consecrated for the priesthood, Nadab and Abihu, his two eldest boys, offer strange fire to the Lord. And God is not pleased with this because it was not according to the command. And so God strikes them down right there in his very presence. A few days later, on the 14th day of that month, the Israelites observe the Passover for the first time after coming out of Egypt. And you'll remember there's the whole question, well, what about if you're unclean from touching a dead body? Can you still take the Passover or do you have to remain out of the camp? Those guys who are asking that question, by the way, are probably the guys, the cousins of Nadab and Abihu, who had to carry their dead bodies out of the tabernacle. And now we're not enough time to get clean. What do we do? Well, they're told that they can observe the Passover on the 14th day of the second month if they're unclean because of a dead body. And then on the first day of the second month of the second year, a census is taken. Remember, we said about 600,000 men, not including women and children, came out of Egypt along with that mixed multitude. When each of the tribes are counted up here, it's just their fighting men, age 20 and over. And the number of that, minus the Levites, is 603,550 men, plus women and children. And again, that doesn't include the tribe of Levi. Levi's tribe was divided into three groups, the Kohathites, the Merarites, and the Gershonites. And those Levites were counted differently. They were counted from 3 months old and upwards, because they were given charge of taking care of the tabernacle. And at the same time, when God tells them to count up the people, he also gives them orders, now that the tabernacle has been built, about how the camp is to be ordered. There were three tribes who would camp on the east, and three on the south, and three on the west, and three on the north, specifically according to God's instructions. And the sons of the Levites, the Kohathites, the Merarites, and the Gershonites, would camp around the tabernacle itself. And God is giving them all this instruction because they're getting ready to set out for the first time now to go on a journey from Sinai as a new nation. And they're given specific marching orders on how they're supposed to go. You've got the three tribes on the east side that set out first, and then Gershon and Merari, they take the tabernacle down and gather up all of its stuff, pack it up, and they follow behind. And then you have three more tribes, and then you have the Kohathites who actually carry all of the articles of the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, the altar, the laver, the lampstand, all of that kind of stuff. They follow along behind, and then the rest of the tribes bring up the rear. And so then, for the first time, on the 20th day of the second month of the second year, they've been at Sinai now for almost 11 months. The cloud rises from above the tabernacle, and God says it's time to move on. And so they set out from Sinai and begin the journey up to Kadesh Barnea. The text tells us that this is only a journey of about 11 days, but I would suggest to you it took the Israelites much longer than that. Remember, we're talking about a couple million people and all their flocks and all their herds. And along the way, a few things happen. The people again complain. We're facing new territory. We're hungry. We're tired of the manna. We want some meat. So God sends them quail again, but he also sends a plague because they're grumbling and complaining against him. Aaron and Miriam, Moses' siblings, challenge Moses. Moses, why do you get to be the only one who leads? Aren't we just as important to you? Well, God doesn't like that. He actually strikes Miriam with leprosy for 7 days. And they have to wait in Hazeroth for 7 days for her leprosy to clear up. Because he's saying, no, Moses is my guy. Listen to him. Okay? Now that's maybe a thread, because later on, Jesus will be standing on the Mount of Transfiguration. with Moses and Elijah. And what does God say on that occasion? This is my, not Moses, listen to him. This is my beloved son, listen to him. I would suggest to you that it's probably towards the end of 1445 when from Kadesh Barnea, 12 spies are sent into the land of Canaan to see how the land is. And they're there for 40 days, and they're checking out all the land, and they bring fruit of the land back. And you'll remember that 10 of the 12 spies said, the land is good, but the people are too big. We can't defeat them. Only Joshua and Caleb said, we can certainly take the land with God's help. But because the people believed the bad report and grumbled against God and didn't trust him, God said, fine, here's your punishment. For every day that the spies were in the land spying it out, you're going to wander in the wilderness for a year. 40 years wandering in the wilderness until everybody who's over the age of 20, except for Joshua and Caleb, pass away in the wilderness. And so from that time, the children of Israel begin to wander in a circular route between Kadesh Barnea and Ezion Geber down at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Back and forth, aimlessly wandering around for the next 37 and a half to 38 years. There's very little that's told to us during this time period. There's an incident about a guy who breaks the Sabbath, and the punishment is stone him to death. There's the account of Korah's rebellion, where Korah, another Levite, along with some others, challenged the authority of Aaron. Why does he get to be a priest alone? Why can't we be a priest? And God opens up the ground and swallows Korah and his household to show, nope, I've chosen Aaron, not you guys. So stop trying to rise up against my instruction. And then to further reinforce that, there was the test of the rods, where they took 12 rods, one from each tribe, and put them in the tabernacle before the Ark of the Covenant. And it was Aaron's rod that budded, bringing forth blossoms and fresh almonds. And that was God's way of showing Aaron's family is the one that I've chosen to be my priests. So don't buck up against my instruction. That's all we're told of what happens over the course of 37 and a half years. Because the next thing that we're told happens in the last year of their wandering in the wilderness, and that is that Miriam, the sister of Moses, dies. 5 months later, Aaron will die at Mount Hor. He'll be replaced as high priest by his now eldest son, Eleazar. And the Israelites will seek to pass through the land of Edom, but are rejected. They said, no, you can't go that way. And so they have to go south yet again, back down to Ezion Geber, and then back around Edom. And it's during this time that they grumble against God again, and God sends the fiery serpents down. And that's when Moses has to raise up the bronze serpent on the standard. Anybody who's bitten and looks at it will be saved. And then as they go around Moab, they end up confronting the Amorites. They defeat Sihon, king of the Ammonites, and Og, king of Bashan. They take possession of their land. They begin to camp now in the plains of Moab at the base of Mount Nebo. And it's here at Mount Nebo that Balak, the king of Moab, who's freaking out, will call Balaam the prophet to come down and try to curse the Israelite camp. And of course, every time Balaam tries to curse them, God turns the curse into a blessing. He won't allow him to do it. But Balaam is successful in getting the Midianites to seduce the Israelites into serving Baal through adultery. And that results in the sin of the Baal of Peor. A plague is sent upon the people. Phinehas shows his zeal by killing a man and a woman who are committing adultery in the presence of everybody, and that checks the plague. And at that time, God says, you know what, we're getting ready to take the land. The 40 years is almost over. We need to make sure all those who are over the age of 20 have died. Let's take another census. And so they take another census on the plains of Moab, and we can see by this graph that the size of each tribe changes just a little bit. Some of them got bigger, some of them got smaller. Overall, the whole nation shrunk by about a little over 1,000 people. But here's something that's interesting. Over the course of the last 38 years, everyone who was over the age of 20 had to die. I found this quote in Wood's commentary. He says, figuring 1.2 million male and men and women over the age of 20 who had to die, in 14,508 days, that is the 38 and a half years, gives 85 deaths per day on average. If figuring 12 hours a day maximum for funerals gives an average of 7 funerals an hour for the whole 38 and a half years, a continuous foreboding reminder of God's punishment upon them. If you think about that, every single day, 85 people are dying in the camp of Israel. Every hour, we're having 7 separate funerals for the entire 38 and a half years that we're wandering in the wilderness. Do you think God was trying to drive home a point with them that when you rebel against me, there are consequences? And the consequence is death. There's only a few more things that are covered in our reading. There was the slaughter of the Midianites, who had again seduced the Israelites into the worship of Baal Peor. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh petitioned Moses to take possession of former land of Og and Sihon on the east side of the Jordan. They say, we want to settle over here. Moses says, that's fine, but you have to promise to go into the land with your brethren to help them conquer it and take possession of it. And then all that's left is Moses' final address to the nation of Israel, which he'll do in the plains of Moab in the 11th month of the 40th year, which is recorded for us in the book of Deuteronomy, before handing the reins of leadership over to Joshua, who will lead the people across the Jordan into the land to take possession of it. And so looking ahead, what we're going to see in our next set of readings is a transition in leadership. We'll see the conquest of the land and the taking possession of it, and how the Israelites fare in the early years of being a full-fledged independent nation.